But today is VE Day. The war is
the
over.
The newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Baillie Gifford. Capital at risk.
Hello and welcome to The Wealth Show. My name is Sophie Downs and I'm joined today by Alex Savides, Fund Manager of the Jupiter UK Dynamic Equity Fund. Thank you for joining us, Alex.
Morning, Sophie.
To start, can you give the listeners who aren't familiar with the strategy a brief introduction to your investment philosophy and how it differs from Ben Whitmore's?
Yeah, hi everyone, and thanks for this opportunity, Sophie. So I manage a fund called Jupiter UK Dynamic. I launched actually a product at a company called J.O. Hambro in 2003 called J.O. Hambro. Actually, I launched it in 2008, J.O. Hambro UK Dynamic. So this is a continuation of that product. I left J.O. Hambro in 2024 at the very beginning of the year in January, to join Jupiter in October 2024 to take over from Ben Whitmore, who was running the UK Special Situations Fund. We've since renamed that fund in October last year to Jupiter UK Dynamic. Ben is a traditional value manager, and I think we are a traditional value manager. I think that was the attraction to Jupiter of me to come and replace Ben when he decided to leave. We do very similar things. We invest in contrarian value stocks, companies that are trading at low prices relative to their earnings, longevity of earnings, cash flows, etc. And we invest accordingly. The difference, I guess, with our strategy versus Ben's is that we focus on a cohort of value companies that are going through business transformation. That typically means that they're going through management and strategic changes, and those changes are aimed at improving financial performance. And so typically, you know, 70% of the funds invested in earlier stage value recovery situations, and then as they transition to sort of value creation through new growth, the other 30-40% of the fund will be in those positions that have already transitioned across. So those are the main differences, but both steeped in value history.
Mm-hmm. And is there an average time history on the companies in the fund, time horizon?
We are very patient. I mean, Ben was a patient investor. I would argue that we're even more patient. If I think back to some of the earlier investments when we launched the product at J.O. Hambro in 2008, when I left in 2024, there were still a large number of companies that went into the fund in those first 2 years that were still in the fund. Companies like 3i, companies like Kinetic, a defense contractor, 3i, private equity business, now investing mostly proprietary capital. Those were investments that we made as transformation investments in 2009 and 2010, and they were still in the fund 14 years later when we left Hambro, mostly because they'd done a fantastic job transforming the business. So when we invest, are we expecting everything to end up being in the fund for 14, 15 years? No, we're not. But are we looking at a time horizon of sort of 5 to 10 years? Yeah, we are, consistently. And you see it time and again with the stocks in the portfolio. 2 to 3 years of sort of transformation, early stage transformation, and then kind of years 3 to 5, the transformation embeds in the business through the organization. And if it's successful, then you get sort of years of growth beyond, you know, years 3 to 5, which can be very powerful to the share price.
Mm-hmm.
Now so going, very patient.
Very patient. Now, going back to the takeover, you inherited a fund had been run by the same manager for 18 years, saw mass outflows when, you know, at the news of his departure. How was the takeover internally?
Yeah, I like to say handover, not takeover. it was as predicted. Actually, let me deal with a few of those things. So it was the first time I had been at J.O. Hambro for 21 years. So this was a big decision for me, as well as it was a big decision for Ben, I'm sure, and I won't speak for him. Now, my team came earlier than I did to Jupiter. They sort of landed in July and August and had time to look at the fund that we were taking over, UK special situations, look at it on a sort of factor basis, the makeup of the fund, its sector exposures, its kind of factor exposures, say, to currency, to geography, to leverage. And there were a few things that we decided we wanted to do. We wanted to take out some cyclicality. We wanted to increase the level of management control by focusing on more very clear change situations. We wanted to take out some cyclicality. There was quite a lot of UK consumer exposure at the time, quite a lot of interest rate exposure. We wanted to take out some exposure to the auto sector. And so actually, when we hit the ground, we sort of not only made the name changes in the portfolio, new names coming in, some leaving, made the capital allocation changes, changing position sizes, but also changed the sort of factor exposure, the sector exposures, dampened down some leverage, dampened down some of those exposures, reduced financials, increased our healthcare weightings. Again, that's been broadly quite a good decision mm-hmm. for the fund. Doing that in the spotlight, doing that, you know, where, you know, I wouldn't say that me coming to Jupiter was the marquee move, but Ben leaving Jupiter was a big thing. Mm-hmm. Had been there, as you say, running the fund for a long period of time and managed a lot of money for Jupiter. And so there was a healthy level of interest in what was going on from everybody, you know, mm-hmm. from Ben's clients, the UK special situations clients that stayed. And I'll come back to your point about flows in a second. There was a level of interest from my old clients that, you know, we had in our own right. We'd built a £3 billion fund at Hambro from nothing in 2008, literally nothing. So everyone was like, well, you know, what's this all about? And then, of course, you've got the internal stakeholder, which is Jupiter, with lots of people at Jupiter saying, who's this guy? Who's this team? What are they all about? What do they do? Why have they been hired? So a lot of work in the first. You're doing it in what I would say, there was a bit of spotlight on us. Yeah. And we walked into a period of time where we had a budget in the UK, mm-hmm. which was not very well received. Of course, Donald Trump was voted in for a second term as well, only a few days later. So the backdrop was to do all of these things in, to make the changes, to think about what you needed to do with the portfolio. The backdrop was extraordinarily volatile. Mm-hmm. Just turning back to the flow picture. So look, it was obvious to myself, I'm sure obvious to Ben, obvious to the executive team at Jupiter that there would be a level of outflows. Broadly, when it was announced that I was leaving, I was managing sort of 2.3, 2.4 billion at Hambro, and Ben's fund was 2.1-ish mm-hmm. For the UK special situations piece that I was taking over. I had a very clear view that we would lose around half of that money over the year. Some of the client base knew me, so we shared clients across the two funds. Some of the client base didn't know me, and it was that client part of the client base, you know, that I thought might walk away. Some of the clients actually had expressed preferences previously to invest in Ben rather than myself. And that's a natural choice that you get from mm-hmm. From the buyers of funds out there. So there was a level of client activity expected by myself. And nothing that we saw over the year was against what we had expected coming in. But actually, the client base that I walked into at roughly a billion, it's still roughly a billion. And obviously, the markets have gone up. We've lost a bit. We've won a few new clients. But it takes time to win your clients back. And it takes time for the new client base to get to know you. But we're getting mm-hmm. there, you know, 9 months down the line and a bit of performance behind us. And a bit of understanding around why we do what we do, how it adds value, mm-hmm. how it's differentiated, you know, how it sits, I think, in a cohort of very few competitors. You know, I think there's evidence to suggest that we're sort of starting to turn Titanic, but we'll see.
Well, before we get into the specifics of the fund, I think let's discuss, you know, the UK market more widely. Yeah. We've been hearing from big investment firms that there's a real change in sentiment towards UK equities. I mean, firstly, is that something you're seeing?
Yeah, I don't think we're all seeing it on the ground in terms of flows. Mm. I don't think there's any evidence to suggest that the flow picture is changing. Is there more interest, inbound interest in what's going on in the UK? Yes, it's to do with lots of things. You know, maybe it's to do with the fact that the UK is a very cheap stock market, has been a very cheap stock market for a long time. But I think we've all known that. Yeah, an interesting situation in the UK. Would I sit here and bet the whole fund on the UK economy? No, I wouldn't. And I don't. Mm-hmm. Don't do that. Actually, we look for balance. And more importantly, we look for the business transformation, idiosyncratic changes that are going on within companies to be the driver of performance, not mm-hmm. whether the UK economy does a GDP of plus one or plus two. But it's a great tailwind if it happens, mm-hmm. you know, and I want to be an active promoter of that.
Mm-hmm. I wanted to touch on a point you made there, which is particularly relevant to our industry, and that's M&A. Yeah. When we last spoke in April, you know, we discussed that you'd recycled your holding out of SJP into Schroders. And I wanted to ask, so, you know, with this backdrop of mergers and acquisitions, what is the investment case for you know, asset management and wealth management companies?
M&A wise, the UK has been an attractive market for a very long time. Coming out of the COVID decline in share prices, we had a hugely active stock market for inbound M&A. And so 2021 and 2022 was a significant period of M&A as essentially private equity bought a lot of very cheap companies. It wasn't necessarily industry consolidating. We had 35, it was ridiculous, 35% of our fund or something was taken over in the space of 18 months. It was absolutely ridiculous. Every day we were waking up and there was a new takeover. Mm. I think, you know, we're seeing a lot of inbound M&A again. Mm-hmm. You know, this time it's more interesting because not only is there private equity M&A, I think there's a bit more industry consolidation as well. Aviva buying Direct Line, which directly impacted us at Jupiter. Myself and Adrian Gosden runs the income mm-hmm. fund, had big positions in Direct Line. Actually, it was one that we had put into the fund as soon as we landed. It wasn't in UK special sits, and it helped the fund outperform in the last quarter of last year. Mm-hmm. But yeah, inbound M&A into the UK market is interesting again. Look mm-hmm. at Spectris. And this time the premiums seem to be even bigger than they were previously. Direct Line, 75% premium, cash and shares bid. Spectris, 80-85% premium. Ricardo recently got taken out at a, I think it was a 60-70% premium as well from its undisturbed price. So lots of interesting things. I just think that speaks to a cheap stock market myself. Mm-hmm. You know, I think that speaks to a cheap stock market and an interesting UK environment that could be getting a bit better mm-hmm. structurally. On the asset managers, look, the asset management companies that are left on the UK stock market, and there are quite a few of them, and there are wealth managers as well, mm. are interesting. They are very cheap optically. They trade at low PEs, but of course they've had some challenges to their business models. And I think that's where you need to be a bit more nuanced with your selection of companies. It's a matter of record and fact that at Hambro, I had a stake in Jupiter in my fund. I, for a number of years, saw an opportunity for Jupiter to be turned around, for it to improve its outlook. Of course, coming to Jupiter to take over this fund, I can't do that now. I see similar characteristics in Schroders. Mm-hmm. You know, what do I like about Jupiter? Why did I come here? As a fund manager, it's a broader asset base than I had at Hambro. Hambro is a very equities-focused business. Mm-hmm. Jupiter's got a wider range. It's got equities, fixed income, credit. It's got systematic with the very successful Gear franchise as well. And it's got a very ambitious management team trying to turn the situation, so very attractive. And it has that breadth of exposures. I think having simple public market equity exposure, that's quite cyclical. It will come and go, sort of thing. But if you have exposures to other parts that give of investment of the investment landscape that give you balance, fixed income as an example, credit as an example, and then of course maybe even private markets mm-hmm. as well, which is worth thinking about in the context of Schroders, and then of course wealth management as well, which is definitely worth thinking about in the context of Schroders. Then I think you become more attractive. You know, there is value across the whole piece. Certainly when I think about some of the parts basis for some of these companies, And that's my view there.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it sounds like there's a huge opportunity there. Do you have any asset managers on your watch list?
Well, look, we own Man as well, which again is a, you know, I think a very interesting asset manager. You know, that's slightly different. Man Group has a fantastic history of generating performance fees. Obviously, you know, it's very famous for its AHL group of funds, which are very momentum focused quant funds, CTAs, as we call them. They have historically generated huge amounts of management fees and performance fees. Man share price seems to be pushed around by prevailing opinion over the performance of the individual funds in any one year and their ability to generate performance fees that have typically been used by the Man management team to buy back stock and to de-equitize. They've been very good capital allocators, very cautious capital allocators. When they do M&A, it's not typically bet the farm M&A, it's sort of piecemeal. And so they're going through one of those periods at the moment where the momentum funds are underperforming. They're not in performance fee earning territory. And so there's been earnings downgrades by the analysts because they have to downgrade the expectations for performance fees in this year particularly. And maybe they then roll that through to next year. But it's left a very cheap, you know, it's a very cheap company with huge optionality in performance fees, huge optionality in the platform it's built. So that's another one in the portfolio, roughly 2% of the fund. We've been involved in that for a very long time. Again, very patient. We think the, you know, the systematic business in that is hugely undervalued, you know, relative to the price you're asked to pay for the whole company.
Let's talk about some of your top holdings. Yeah. So since the looking at fact sheets since the beginning of the year, there's been some shifts in the top 10. Yeah. But your number one, Convatec Limited, has stayed the same. So how does this company kind of embody that transformation, that philosophy you were talking about?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it's probably the best example of the of a successful business transformation that we have in the fund at the moment, hotly followed by Babcock, which had results today. Yes. And has been a sort of 4 or 5 year transformation. But look, turning back to Convatec, and some context here for listeners. Convatec is a company that we've been involved in since 2019. It's a company we followed since it came to the stock market in 2015. It is a medical products company serving chronic care markets from kind of type 1 diabetes patients to ostomy care patients. And when it was listed on the stock market, I, for one, thought that they were listed at slightly high valuation with operating margins that were difficult to support because they weren't investing in R&D. 2% of sales was going into R&D, and that had come down over the period of ownership that the private equity house had owned it. So you could see that they were kind of taking money from R&D, possibly to kind of make the margins look optically higher. That, of course, all comes home to roost eventually in the stock market. That, you know, the stock market are very good at nosing these things out. And if you don't refresh your product portfolio as a corporate, you know, you don't exist in a vacuum. You exist versus competition. You will lose market share. And this company started to lose market share in its ostomy business, which was a mainstay business for this company. So cure a period of profit warnings, cure a period where the management team was kicked out. In fact, we had virtually full board refresh from executive to non-executive, and the chair changed as well. That is exactly the type of situation that we look for. A potentially high quality, long-term growth business serving healthcare markets, chronic care markets, where there is high recurring revenue. You take on an ostomy care client that has to wear an ostomy bag. They're probably wearing that till end of life. And not probably, they will be. And so, you know, sadly, they're very enduring revenue streams once you get them. Same with type 1 diabetes patients. So attractive in financial terms, in markets, strong revenues, as long as you have the right product set, the right management, there's something interesting there. What do we look for next? Well, we interview the management when they come in and think about the new strategy. And what we heard from that management team in 2019 was that they were prepared to invest. They were prepared to bring those operating margins down to give the company a better future by investing in R&D. And so 2% of sales has become 6% of sales and is still rising in R&D. And so we think the multiple today at 20 times is ludicrous. to worry about that in 2 years' time. That multiple is going to be down to sort of 13, 14. And, you know, the balance sheet's deleveraging very quickly. This really has the characteristics of 3i. We had 3i in the portfolio from, as I say, 2009 to 2015, 16. It did the value recovery where the multiple went back to its historic past on what we would argue was a better business. And then for the next, you know, for the next kind of 10 years, it's still going today. And it's not in our portfolio today. We've not had it for the last year, but for the next 10 years, the share price kind of tripled in the value creation piece, where the compound growth characteristics of some of the assets in the portfolio came through. This could be similar. This is the only asset in the portfolio at the moment. Maybe Babcock's got a chance as well, that's got the ability to grow consistently.
I want to zoom in on the point about investment because I think that's really interesting. I, you know, I think I've spoken to a lot of UK fund managers, and the sense is that the UK really doesn't like when a company has to invest. The stock market doesn't like that. But obviously a big tenet of your philosophy is going and meeting these managers when they're in a period of change. So is that, you know, often a catalyst for future growth, that willingness to invest?
A number of things there to talk about. Look, we want companies to become better versions of themselves. And to think that you can only become a better version of yourself by cutting costs is super short-sighted, right? You live in a highly, you trade in a highly competitive global market, particularly for companies like Convatec that was losing market share hand over fist to Coloplast, which is, you know, a listed competitor, listed in Europe, has consistently traded at a multiple over 30. There's very little, you know, they're very similar businesses. It had higher margins. You know, and I use that as an example. So when we invest in Convatec, yeah, we know what the problem is. We know that the problem is that you've underinvested relative to competition, and therefore you need to refresh your product base. You need to stay fresh. You need to stay agile. You need to stay fit for purpose. You need to stay relevant. Could be talking about fund managers here, you know, and the funds they run. But it's, you know, the stakes are high. The investment has to be well placed. It has to be made by the right management team with the right strategy. That's why we engage so closely with these companies to think logically about whether it's the right strategy, a good strategy. We don't read books about, you know, being good value managers. We know we're good value managers. We read books about good strategy, you know, about how to turn businesses around, how to create value from businesses through focus strategies, through reinvestment strategies. So, yeah, it's an interesting arbitrage in the stock market between the here and now. And say declining earnings forecast now because you're investing now, and the future outcome of those earnings. We have the will to believe that well-placed investment will have a future revenue payoff for certain companies, and we're willing to back that. But, you know, we have a high hurdle, and we expect managers to have a high hurdle when they reinvest.
Well, thinking about, you know, one of your holdings that is doing very well, which we've seen this morning, is, of course, Babcock. 4.7% of your fund. You know, maybe for those listening, you could give a brief description on what Babcock does.
So Babcock is a defence business in the UK. It's very famous for running a couple of the big nuclear facilities in the UK. So it has the main contract for repair and maintenance of the nuclear submarine fleet. It runs Rosyth Dockyard. It runs Devonport as well. These are assets that the company owns outright and are key defence assets for the UK government. And I think they have a critical position. They're a critical national infrastructure, if you ask me, particularly as we think about how we, you know, how we improve our defence capability for the future in what is a very challenging geopolitical environment. So, you know, but turning it back to business transformation, but a business that historically, through the last decade, had a lot of challenges, invested a lot internationally in M&A within the UK that didn't really pay off. And there were a number of acquisitions that they made that didn't work for them. another part of the story, you know, when we landed here at Jupiter in October last year, Ben and Dermot had a small stake in Babcock, had roughly 1% of the fund in it. We highlighted it straight away as something that had the characteristics to be very powerful. And we took that 1% to roughly 4.5%, which is sort of where it is now. But, you know, the shares have gone up sort of nearly threefold since we took that decision. So it's been a very powerful driver of returns for our shareholders.
Well, I think Babcock's a really interesting study. I mean, for listeners, you know, at the time of recording, they had great results this morning on the back of many of these factors. Figures I've got, revenues up by 11%, shares up 12% in early trading. But I mean, obviously, you know, the wider question is, this is a strategy focused on idiosyncratic returns rather than macro conditions. But how much are the companies in this fund benefiting from UK tailwinds and stimulus?
Yeah, look, the way we think about macro more broadly factors and the impact on a company's revenues and profits and future outlook, we see it as optionality. Every single stock that goes into the portfolio has to stand up on its own metrics. So, you know, it has to have a value case independent of what goes on in the wider macro universe. We are not buying Babcock because we're making big, broad predictions about how much defense expenditure might go up. We might buy Babcock going, okay, if they were to do X, Y, and Z, they could repair margins. Let's say they repair margins by taking cost out, and then they improve cash flow by just being better at working capital management. Back to your question, we don't buy them for the macro, we buy them for the individual business transformation characteristics. And then as time goes on, as things change, maybe the macro becomes optionality that feeds into the valuation of the company. And then we'll take a judgment call over time as the stock market comes back to investing in that company. And there are an excess of buyers over sellers at the moment. That's why the share price is going up. We'll think about when we exit.
Okay, well, we've spoken about new companies in the fund. What, on the flip side, what is the most recent company you've sold and why?
We've sold EasyJet recently, actually. That's sort of fairly hot off the press. Look, no, nothing against that as a company. It's a cheap stock. It's a well-managed business. It has some interesting characteristics. The analyst community is quite excited about its ability to take share in the holidays market. It's selling hotel packages along with its sort of standard seats on EasyJet planes and doing it very successfully. I personally wonder about the sort of margins that they generate in that part of the business. But, you know, that's a personal view. I think they're a bit high relative to what they do. And there's a lot of competition out there for that. The other part of the story at EasyJet is that it is a business that needs to reinvest in its fleet. And so it's going to go through a big CapEx program for the next few years. And over that period of time, I think it's, you know, free cash flow will be a little bit challenged because they have to spend, a bit underwhelming. And then on top of all of that, it just doesn't have the requisite management control that we would look for. It's very dependent on external macro and geopolitical factors. So it's a very volatile business. Flying, you know, running an airline is a very volatile business. You know, you need to pack the seats, you need to hope that you can buy your petrol, your fuel at the right price. And you need to hope that you are able to land your planes where you want to land them. And at the moment, you can't land them in certain places in the Middle East. So it doesn't really conform to the characteristics that we look for. It was a stock that we inherited in the fund. We could see that it had value characteristics. As other ideas have become more important to us, we've used EasyJet as a stock that doesn't really conform to our business transformation ethos as purely as some other ones, and we put the capital elsewhere.
Okay, well, I think that's all we have time for. Thank you so much for joining us. It's been such an interesting conversation.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for joining us today, and we'll see you next week for another episode of The Wealth Show.
But today is VE Day. The war is
the newly crowned queen waves from the balcony.
Eagle has landed. Apollo 11 has landed.
Tearing down the Berlin Wall.
Since 1929, the Monks Investment Trust's mission has been to help investors grow their wealth. We aim to do this today by taking a three-dimensional approach to growth. Cyclical growth, rapid growth, and steady growth.
The World Wide Web.
Wall Street is in turmoil as stocks crash.
The Monks Investment Trust, managed by Bailey Gifford. Capital at risk.